From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It is Halloween. It's also 6 days before the election. President Trump hits the campaign trail again today, hoping to talk immigration after visiting Pittsburgh yesterday to pay respects after the synagogue shooting. Democrats across the country are making their final pitch to voters, many focusing their message on health care. We're joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
So you are about to join President Trump in his latest campaign push. He is heading to Florida. One of the things people have noticed about his schedule leading up to the midterms at this point is that he seems to be focused mainly on Senate races. Has he given up on Republicans keeping the House?
I don't think he's given up. I think Republicans are engaged in a mad scramble to keep their losses in the House as low as possible. But the president has been going to red states, states where he's popular. He isn't campaigning in blue districts where he's not popular. And it just so happens that this year, the Senate battleground is a bunch of very red states that he won, where his approval rating is very high. And there just happens to be Democratic Senate incumbents running for re-election in those states. So that's where he's focusing.
Meanwhile, he's been talking, as we've been talking about the last 24 hours or so, about ending so-called birthright citizenship. He said today on Twitter that it will be ended one way or the other, even though it is protected by the Constitution. And constitutional scholars have said it would not be possible for him to end it by executive order. We remember that it was a week ago, Mara, that he was talking about passing a middle-class tax cut before the election. Do these last-minute policy appeals work for voters?
Well, he thinks they work for his base. Don't forget, immigration is the number one issue. It's the number one culture war issue that he thinks energizes his voters. That's what birthright citizenship is for. He also is sending 5,200 troops to the border, even though that caravan is mostly filled with women and kids, and it's hundreds of miles away from the U.S. border. But the 10% tax cut gambit is defensive, and he proposed that because the tax cut that the Republicans already passed is so unpopular. And middle-class people and Republicans' own internal polls show that people think it was a tax cut for the rich, not for them.
So he's appealing to his base. But can Republicans do what they want to do in these midterms just with the base?
Well, that's what the president's theory is. It's always all about the base with him. And the problem for a lot of Republicans in these affluent, educated suburban districts is they need more than the base. They need independent voters. And they've been struggling. Members of Congress in those districts have been struggling.
What about the other big story of this week, which is, of course, the terrible shooting in Pittsburgh and following up on the pipe bombs that were sent to some of the president's critics? He's been blaming the media for a climate of violence, creating that climate of violence. Many have been blaming him and his rhetoric. What are voters thinking as they look at all that?
Well, what we have seen is over the last week or two, his approval rating has dipped. And we saw this before after Charlottesville, when he said there were good people on both sides, neo-Nazis and the counter-protesters. And when the president tries to deal with a national tragedy like this, he often suffers in the eyes of voters because he doesn't do this very well. He doesn't do empathy. He doesn't see himself as a moral leader. He doesn't see his role as healing. His go-to strategy is division. And just to illustrate this, he went to Pittsburgh yesterday. He visited the synagogue. And what he tweeted today, he said, "Melania and I were treated very nicely yesterday in Pittsburgh. The office of the president was shown great respect on a very sad and solemn day. We were treated so warmly. Small protest was not seen by us, staged far away. The fake news stories were just the opposite, disgraceful." Not a word about the victims or the community. It was all about him. And I think this is why he really has a hard time with voters when he tries to rise to the occasion or doesn't try to rise to the occasion, as the case may be.
What are the numbers telling you at this point about early voting and turnout?
What the numbers are telling us about early voting and turnout is that this could be a historic turnout election for a midterm. We have millennials and young voters, at least based on their early voting turnout, reaching perhaps record levels. Democrats have been extremely energized this entire cycle, but Republicans are energized too. I think this is going to be a big, big turnout election for a midterm. And I think that's a really good thing.
Mariah, we have 5 seconds left, but I want to ask you, what is the state that you're going to be watching on election night, the big race?
Florida. The Florida governor's race. Yeah. The Florida governor's race is the single most important race for 2020, the most important race for Donald Trump. Same with the Ohio governor's race, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Those are the races he needs to go Republican for his reelection campaign.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson.
Well, let's check in now on the race for governor in the state of Alaska, because it was a three-way race until October 19th, just weeks before Election Day, when Governor Bill Walker, an independent, said this at the Alaska Federation of Natives.
Effective today, I am suspending my campaign for the re-election as governor. In the time remaining, it has become clear we cannot win a three-way race.
Well, Walker then threw his support behind the Democratic candidate, former U.S. Senator Mark Begich, who was trailing in the polls behind the Republican, former state Senator Mark Dunleavy. And now that race has tightened. Politico writes that Republicans' surest chance to pick up a governorship on Tuesday has suddenly turned into the weirdest, least predictable campaign in the country. Andrew Kitchenman is a state government and politics reporter at KTOO and Alaska Public Media. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Robin.
So if you're going to have a weird race, let it be the weirdest, and this sounds like it. And just take us back a second, because the sitting governor, Bill Walker's running mate, who was his lieutenant governor, Byron Mallott, stepped down a week before the governor made his announcement that he wouldn't be running. And Mallott resigned over an inappropriate comment to an unnamed woman. Did that have anything to do with why Governor Walker stepped down, or was it simply because, as he said, he felt he couldn't win in a three-way race and he wanted to throw his support behind the Democrat?
He really stopped because of the Mallott issue. Both he and Begich all along have wanted one or the other. They both have wanted the other to drop out. They're pretty similar on the issues. There are some differences on social issues, but Walker has really downplayed social issues as governor and is really focused on economic and non-social issues. So in practical terms, there wasn't a lot of difference between the two of them, and they were pretty evenly splitting the non-Republican vote.
Yeah, but then when Mallott made that comment, it seemed to be the time to make an exit. Look, just after Walker left the race, an Alaska Survey research poll had Dunleavy, the Republican, up only 4 points. He'd been higher. So talk about how this race has changed.
Yeah. So a challenge for Begich is that Walker's name is still on the ballot. Even though he suspended his campaign, it happened after the withdrawal deadline. And there isn't a lot of precedence for having an incumbent governor's name on the ballot and them not campaigning. So as you could imagine, if he gets 5%, if he gets 10%, that's largely going to be votes coming out of Begich's likely voters. And he may get those votes just because people either aren't informed about the latest news or they really like Walker and they don't like the other two names on the ballot.
Yeah. Well, so that again, that's what makes this so weird, is that Begich still could look really good in the polls, but we'll have to wait till we get out the other side on November 6th to see what people actually did. And let's talk about the candidates. Walker, again, who's no longer in the race, he cited protecting Medicaid when he dropped out. Dunleavy has opposed the Medicaid expansion that Walker created in 2015. In a debate last week, Dunleavy talked about Medicaid and management issues. Let's listen to a little.
We need to manage our government better. We have Medicaid overture spending. We have a whole host of issues in terms of management issues in our government.
What does Dunleavy mean when he talks about managing our government better?
He hasn't been very clear on what that would mean in terms of the actual state budget. There is concerns among public employee labor unions that he may be basically aiming to take on unions as far as reducing compensation or reducing public employee benefits. But it doesn't look like voters are going to have a clear idea about what direction Dunleavy's going to take the state when he talks about management.
And what about the Democratic candidate, Begich? He's talked about possible revenue packages, which could include a tax. And this would be new for Alaska, the only state without either an income or a sales tax. Begich has also talked about the Alaska Permanent Funds Dividend, PFD. These are the payments that come from the oil industry that every Alaskan receives. Here's part of one of Begich's ads.
We can't wait 4 more years for leadership, much less go backwards. Guaranteeing school funding and the PFD in the state constitution is the right place to begin.
Is the implication there that Dunleavy isn't guaranteeing the PFD this payment?
Well, possibly. Dunleavy's actually proposing a higher PFD payment than Bagich, but Bagich wants to put it in the state constitution. This was a check that everyone received up until 3 years ago, and it's a large check. Bagich is looking for about a $2,000 PFD. Dunleavy's talking about about roughly $3,000 PFD. Neither has been really clear about how they're going to pay for it, and the fear is that they're just going to draw down the state's large savings, all that oil wealth. Some of it's protected by the state constitution, but some of it isn't. And the more of that money spent, the could have really rough implications for this state's future.
That's Andrew Kitcherman, state government and politics reporter at KTOO and Alaska Public Media, on again what some people are calling the weirdest and least predictable campaign in the country going into the midterms, the governor's race there in Alaska. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's a quirk of Florida politics. Every 20 years, around 3 dozen people gather together to come up with amendments to the state constitution. Florida is the only state that has this kind of commission, which bundles together a number of issues into one yes or no question. Danny Rivero of WLRN explains.
If you live in Florida on Election Day, you'll get the option to ban offshore drilling and also ban vaping in the workplace. Or you can vote to change the state college system and also give more death benefits to the families of first responders and members of the military. These two items on the November ballot are the product of the Florida Constitution Revision Commission.
And the voter has to make a terrible choice.
Ellen Friedan was on the Revision Commission 20 years ago in 1998.
Do I vote for the thing I don't like in order to get the thing I do like? And that's just not fair and not acceptable. I think that what the Constitution Revision Commission did is it packed things that they thought would be popular along with things that they really wanted but thought wouldn't be popular.
That's how Broward County's top administrator Bertha Henry sees it too, particularly on a question that would do three things at once: mandate a state Department of Veteran Affairs, mandate a state anti-terrorism office, and something Henry's not happy with: force every county to have 5 elected government officials, including sheriff and supervisor of elections.
The amendment that's on the agenda, it's sandwiched in between motherhood and apple pie.
The commission has been putting seemingly unrelated questions together on the ballot since it was first formed in 1978. But the way Friedan and some legal experts see it, this time is different. 20 years ago, the decision about who would be on the commission came from a mix of Democrats and Republicans. That meant an almost even split between the two parties, says Ellen Friedan.
Anything that got passed through that Constitution Revision Commission had to be seriously debated, compromises had to be made, and it had to be something that was agreeable on a bipartisan level.
But this year, every appointment was made by Republicans or Republican-appointed officials, and that can make things look political, even if they're not. Anna Marie Gámez was on this year's commission, on the committee that helped write the language voters will see. She says politics were not at play, just plain logic.
So when we first started meeting, we all came to the table with ideas of how things might be grouped. And everything really had a somewhat of a nexus or a natural connection.
Gámez offers the example of Amendment 9, which would ban offshore drilling and vaping at work.
But if you look at it from a let's make our environment more friendly and protect our state and protect our citizens, I think that you can kind of see why they would have fit together. I can't say that personally I agreed with all of the groupings, and my voting record would speak to that. But for the most part, I did, and I thought that we put things together in a way that just, it made sense.
Gámez says there's another reason for grouping amendments. In some places, ballots are nearly 20 pages long this year, so the commission wanted to stop voter fatigue.
Just make this shorter and easier for people.
There's just one rule the commission has to follow. According to the Florida Constitution, the title and the summary of the amendment need to be clearly understood by voters. Timothy McClendon is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Florida.
That it needs to clearly state the chief purpose. It needs to be comprehensible. And so the more you unfold some different disparate subjects, that can really be a challenge there.
The Florida Supreme Court already ruled that one bundled amendment was not clear enough for voters. It was about charter schools, and it didn't use the phrase charter schools. So that was removed from the ballot. three other amendments were in jeopardy of being tossed off the ballot, until this month when the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that they would stay. Justice Barbara Pariente wrote the questions were improperly bundled, and they didn't give voters a clear choice of what they're voting on. But the legal filing that was used to make that argument was the improper vehicle. Justice Pariente had two words for people looking at these questions on the ballot. Voters, beware. For Here and Now, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Whether you're a voter in Florida or another state, you may also have ballot measures to weigh in on Election Day. This year, there are 155 statewide ballot measures in 37 states. 64 of them are citizen-led initiatives. They're an example of direct democracy, letting voters, rather than legislatures, decide policies and laws. Joining us now is Josh Altick, who's the project director for the Ballot Measures Project at Ballotpedia. Josh, welcome.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you.
And how does the number of statewide ballot initiatives this year compare to other years?
Overall, the total number of statewide measures has been decreasing over the last decade or so. There's been a trend towards fewer and fewer. But in 2016 and 2018, there has been a resurgence specifically in citizen-initiated measures, measures that get on the ballot through a signature petition signed by registered voters.
And in those citizen-initiated ballot measures, if they get passed, do they become law, or is it something that then just gets referred to the legislature to make a decision about?
Those have gone to the ballot for final approval from the voters. There are a couple of exceptions. For example, in Nevada, there's a measure that has to get approved again in 2020 if it passes in 2018. But these measures are going to the voters, and the voters have the last say on them.
So what kind of issues are we talking about here? I see that a lot of them have to do with elections and voting.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest trends we're seeing in 2018. Things like redistricting systems, adding commissions or changing the requirements for redistricting. Marijuana is another topic that's been on the ballot a lot. You know, in recent years has been a trend, and it's sort of continuing this year. Other election policies related measures, things like voting requirements.
Voter ID.
Campaign finance and ethics is another big issue in North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri.
How difficult is it to get some of these initiatives onto the ballot?
The process varies by state. The number of signatures required is usually based on a percentage of voter turnout, either for the president, for the governor, or for maybe the secretary of state. And the total number varies from a little over 13,000 in a small state like North Dakota to over 500,000 in California this year. The cost on average was $1 million, a little over $1 million in 2018 for these initiatives.
So does that mean that it is mostly big organizations who get behind these things and get them on the ballot, or could it just be Jane Q. Voter?
There are a few sort of really true grassroots volunteer efforts, but for the most part, if these things are costing over $1 million, you either have to have a rich individual, an industry, or a special group, a national interest group that's behind you to provide the funding to get these on the ballot.
I can imagine that in some cases, state legislators would be happy that something is put to the voters so they don't have to make the call themselves. And in other cases, they might not be happy because it ties their hands.
Yeah, in general, implicit in the initiative process is a conflict between citizens or registered voters and the legislature. The backers of these initiatives generally use the initiative process as a sort of a method of last resort. If they're not getting what they want done in the legislature and they see an opportunity that voters might approve a policy that the legislature has either not acted on or has opposed. But there's always some exceptions that prove the rule. And there are cases where politically connected people go to the initiative process, and that could be for a variety of reasons. But for the most part, the citizen initiative process is used when the policies aren't being approved in the legislature.
Now, sometimes the voters decide on something and then the state either drags its feet or decides it doesn't want to go through with it. In Maine last year, 60% of voters approved a ballot initiative to expand Medicaid to cover tens of thousands more people. But the governor there, Paul LePage, has blocked implementation and there's an ongoing legal battle over it. How often does that kind of thing happen?
As you see the initiative process have its resurgence, so as you see more initiatives, you see the number of instances where that conflict I was talking about that's implicit boils to the surface. The response to the 2016 initiatives was, in many cases, to either repeal or change the initiatives if possible, and some states allow that, some don't, or to pass restrictions on the process. And then the sort of the third response we've seen is an effort to compromise in 2018 with initiative proponents instead of letting it go to the ballot and letting it be this sort of hard battle, trying to find some sort of deal they can make where initiative proponents withdraw and the policy still gets at least some sort of advancement if it's not the full effort that the initiative proponents wanted.
What is the thought about how useful ballot questions are?
Direct democracy is really important in the U.S. Every state but Delaware, so 49 states, require voters to ratify constitutional amendments. So even if the legislature puts it on the ballot, the voters still have to vote on it. The question really comes down to, and the argument is about citizen-initiated measures where, you know, an industry or a corporation or an out-of-state interest or grassroots volunteer efforts can put a measure on the ballot by collecting a certain number of signatures. Only 26 states have any process that's similar to that. One of the most common arguments in opposition this year is out-of-state interests and industries or special interests usurping the process and using it to put forward some sort of policy that benefits them and doesn't benefit the voters.
Mm-hmm.
And behind that is this idea that you can confuse or dupe the voters into approving something that they don't want to approve. In support, people always just argue that when you put something directly before the voters, you have to just trust the voters will actually be able to vote according to their values. And that requires an informed electorate and a lot of discussion and spreading around the information so that voters can have the information they need on election day to vote their values.
But you wonder how many voters actually do have the information they need on election day to vote about some of these things, which they probably don't spend that much time thinking about.
Right. Yeah. And that's why Ballotpedia exists. We've seen that need. And that's a real concern that, I mean, is being expressed all over the place. In fact, this year, there are ballot measures that address ballot measures. There's some meta-ballot measures. For example, in South Dakota, there are measures to increase the voter requirement threshold to require 55% instead of just 50. Should there be some protections involved, and should there be some more criteria that prevent any sort of manipulating of the voters?
That is Josh Altick, who is project coordinator for the Ballot Measures Project at Ballotpedia. Josh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And what do you think about ballot measures, direct democracy? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Whatever you tell us may become law.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
If Democrats take back control of the House of Representatives next Tuesday, one of their priorities will be taking on Big Pharma. So what might happen to drug prices? Lev Fasher is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's with us from Washington. Hi, Lev.
Thanks for having me.
And you report that House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has a plan to tackle drug prices, and she has let pharmaceutical companies know about it. What is it?
Yeah, we reported yesterday that over the summer, Nancy Pelosi walked into the pharma boardroom, which is a group essentially of very powerful drug company executives, and made this threat essentially that talked about the government's right to, in extreme circumstances, strip drug companies of licenses to drugs that make them millions and millions of dollars. It's unlikely that the federal government would use that tool. But what's notable is the tone with which Pelosi has been talking to the pharmaceutical lobby in the months before an election that's likely to make her Speaker of the House again. So a couple of the planks that her party has talked about include allowing Medicare to negotiate for drug prices, mm-hmm. which is currently prohibited. And another is the installation of a Senate-confirmable price gouging enforcer. In Pelosi's plan, someone who would monitor drug companies for price hikes, and if it's determined that the price hike is not, from a business perspective, justifiable, the price gouging enforcer would be empowered to fine that company proportional to the price increase and give the money to the National Institutes of Health to use for research.
And Big Pharma is against that. What about Republicans? President Trump has talked a lot about trying to bring down drug prices. Would he be on board with this idea, or do they have ideas of their own to bring down drug prices?
The idea of this strange bedfellows alliance between Donald Trump's White House and Nancy Pelosi's House of Representatives is certainly an alarming prospect to the pharmaceutical industry here in D.C. it's unclear whether Republicans in the House, and especially Republicans in the Senate, they're likely to keep control of that chamber, would go along with any of Pelosi's proposals. In fact, it's likely that a lot of the House proposals that Democrats approve could be dead on arrival in the Senate. But if all of a sudden the Trump administration and Alex Azar, the health secretary, are willing to work with Pelosi on some of the more consensus proposals, all of a sudden it could put a Republican-controlled Senate in a bind, and it could really put a lot of pressure on the pharmaceutical industry to beat back a lot of these proposals. But it's not likely that the White House, for instance, would support something as bold as Part D negotiation. Trump had talked on the campaign trail before his election that allowing Medicare to negotiate prices appeared to be a no-brainer, has since backed off that pledge. It's something Democrats are really hitting him hard for.
And is it something you think that people are going to go out to the polls to vote on? We know that health care is a big issue in general. What about drug prices?
Healthcare is a big issue. Within it, drug prices are a huge issue. A lot of the pollsters I've talked to, a lot of the folks in state parties around the country say that when they call voters in various legislative districts, the high cost of prescription medicines is among the things they want government to address most and most urgently. And another thing to bear in mind is that the Republican tax bill passed last year is not particularly popular, and one element within it that really riles up voters is the perception that pharmaceutical companies saved billions of dollars collectively from that tax cut, which is true. It's not a popular element of that tax bill.
That is Lev Fasher at STAT. Lev, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And we're following a story involving special counsel Robert Mueller, and it's not about the results of his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 elections or possible collusion with the Trump campaign. It's about allegations Mueller's office has referred to the FBI that women were offered money to make false sexual misconduct claims about him. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us now. Phil, this is weird, but what do we know so far about this story?
It's a very weird story. If it's a hoax, it appears to be a hoax within a hoax. So there were these allegations that came into inboxes in Washington of reporters, including NPR, from someone who called herself a woman in Florida who had allegedly been offered money to make these false charges against Mueller. And what may be the case is that woman actually does not exist, and that those false charges were in fact false charges about false charges. What isn't clear is whether this was intended to embarrass the special counsel's office or just to embarrass the journalists who had been sent this email as they tried to investigate and report on it.
Or is it possible that these women, because I want to be clear, this woman was trying to alert that neither was true, that she was trying to alert Mueller's office that someone was trying to take him down?
We're not aware of any contact between the women involved here and the special counsel's office. It's all been done through journalist intermediaries, and they've reached out to the special counsel's office to ask about this. And when it became aware of those outreach attempts, then that's what it referred to the FBI.
Okay. Well, there are two conservative media personalities, Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman, who are said to be linked to this story. Tell us more about that.
That's right. Wohl is a young man who writes for the website Gateway Pundit. Berkman has a show on Newsmax TV, which is owned by President Trump's friend and supporter, Chris Ruddy. And what they've said is the special counsel investigation is itself a hoax, that it's illegal and that it's unfounded. And they want to expose what they call the crimes or the venality involving the special counsel's office and Mueller himself. And that is the background for these accusations or alleged accusations this week involving putative misconduct by Mueller. They appeared in these emails to news organizations and also on Gateway Pundit yesterday, Tuesday, in the form of a so-called intelligence report that was linked to a so-called intelligence agency, which in its way was kind of a parody of the Steele dossier, which, by the way, is partly unverified because no one knows which things in it are true and which things are not. And it became clear to people looking at this online that this alleged intelligence agency was made up of a series of suspicious LinkedIn pages. And the profile pictures of the people who had those pages were people like actors and models, not real human beings.
Okay, well, now my head has officially exploded and we have about less than a minute left. So is the speculation that these conservative personalities might have been behind paying these women to say something about Mueller? I mean, what is the possibility here?
there may never have been any women at all. And those payments or those accusations were themselves just a trap to try to get reporters to talk about them. None of that is clear. However, we do know the special counsel's office has asked the FBI to get to the bottom of this. And if it does and there are criminal charges or there is some kind of report from the FBI, we may learn what the real story was that was taking place behind all of this.
In other words, if somebody was masquerading as a woman saying that there were sexual misconduct allegations about Mueller and she was to receive money and someone had made that up, they would be in trouble. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing in Washington, we will follow this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, earlier this month, a federal judge in California blocked the Trump administration's plans to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for immigrants from Sudan, El Salvador, Haiti, and Nicaragua. That ruling meant that an estimated 300,000 immigrants didn't have to have an immediate threat of deportation, but many of them had lives that were already turned upside down during the 10-plus months when they believed they'd have to leave the United States. Hiwaida El-Arabi is one example of that. She's a TPS holder from Sudan. It's a recently war-torn country, but she left for other reasons of fears of her personal safety and until a few weeks ago was prepared to lose her temporary protected status on November 2nd, which had been the deadline. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And how long have you lived in the U.S. under this temporary protected status?
I have been here since 1997, so it's 21 years.
21 years.
Yes.
I'm not going to ask age, but it feels as if that would be a good deal of your life.
Yes, that's a big chunk of my life.
And you haven't returned to Sudan during that time?
No, not at all.
So I know you can't talk about why you came here because you have an asylum case?
That is correct.
What kind of life had you created here in the United States?
United States has been very kind to me. I was able to further my education. I have a master's degree in bioinformatics from Brandeis University. I worked with the Department of Public Health as a health educator for 18 years. And right now I work with Western Governors University, an online school that is based in Utah. Right now I'm working with them as an e-care coordinator.
Yeah.
So we provide academic and technical help online for the students.
Well, and we should note, since it's a sensitive subject for TPS holders, that the government didn't pay for your education. You paid for that yourself. So having crafted that life, you now find yourself embroiled in an asylum case, whether or not you can receive asylum in this country, and you were under this threat of deportation. What did you think when you heard that your status would be ended?
It was terrifying. It was terrifying, actually. I have been here for 21 years, and when you live in a place for that long, it becomes home. You build a life. You raise up kids. I don't have kids, but I know so many of TPS holders who are raising up kids here.
You're a community here.
Yes, a big community. So I think the estimate is close to 400,000 people who are TPS holders right now in the United States from different countries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I understand that you actually started to prepare for having perhaps to leave by the end of this week, that you shut things down? I mean, what did you do thinking you might have to leave?
Yeah, that's true, because I used to own a restaurant. It's a dream that I wanted for so long, and I was able to achieve that dream in 2015. I bought a restaurant, and when TPS has been canceled, I had to take steps that I didn't think I will need to do, which is I sold the restaurant because I wasn't sure if even I will be here to manage that restaurant. I was terrified that I'm going to also lose my job right now with the university because with TPS deadline, everything stops. So driver's license, work, everything that you have stops with the cancellation of TPS. It was a roller coaster and it was really terrifying.
So you already sold your business.
Yes,
that
I did.
That was your dream. And then you were looking ahead and thinking, boy, on November 2nd, I would lose, as you said, my license, everything that enables me to function and possibly your other job, which is working with this online university.
Yes.
So that had to be a frightening time. But can you understand, I mean, President Trump and the Trump administration's rationale for terminating temporary protected status for Sudanese immigrants like yourself is that Sudan is no longer a dangerous place to live, according to them. The last civil war it is over. You say what?
The civil war might be over in the headlines, but the situation in the ground is not that great.
And again, you were here throughout a time where you could not have gone back at all.
No,
you've been legal up until this change in American policy. You were part of the lawsuit that resulted in the Trump administration's decision being blocked. You took this before that judge that overturned that November 2nd date. But there could be another date. Are you still living in fear that, you know, any day now this could happen?
Yes, because the judge decision is a temporary relief until the judge decides on the case. And this is not a final solution to our status. That's why we're hoping that Congress will look into this and give us a chance. If they give us a thoughtful look, they will see that TPS holders are really very integrated in the American society. And we are business owners. We are your colleagues at work. Our kids are friends with your kids in school. And we are contributing to the American society.
Yeah. See a lot of emotion in your face, yeah. That's Hiwaida El Arabi, a Sudanese immigrant with temporary protected status. And a federal judge just overruled the Trump administration's plans to end that temporary protected status for immigrants from Sudan by November 2nd. So we wait to see how this plays out. Hiwaida, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
More funerals today in Pittsburgh as three more victims of Saturday's synagogue shooting are laid to rest. Meanwhile, the self-described free speech social media platform where the suspected shooter posted anti-Semitic messages before carrying out his deadly attack is under renewed scrutiny. Gab.com is losing investors and has been taken offline after the web hosting service GoDaddy said the site violated its terms of service. Let's bring in Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the suspected shooter had a history of posting anti-Semitic messages on Gab, including one posted just before authorities say he walked into the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh and killed 11 people. That one read, "Screw your optics, I'm going in." Now, Gab says they have a zero-tolerance policy for violence and terrorism, but it looks like the suspected shooter here posted a lot of threats without any repercussions. Tell us first a little bit about Gab and its connection to what happened here.
Gab is a two-year-old site that markets itself as a free speech alternative to Facebook and Twitter. So Facebook and Twitter already allow pretty much all legal speech that isn't physically threatening. So you might think, why do you need a free speech alternative to sites that already allow free speech? And the answer is that Gab is essentially a cult platform. It's a place where white nationalists and Nazis and racists and extremists can talk amongst themselves on a social network where they feel comfortable and unafflicted by public commentary, where they won't be criticized for their hateful rhetoric. Now, Robert Bowers, the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter, he joined Gab in January this year. He was very active in posting anti-Jewish images and messages. And last week, he was on Gab passing along conspiracy theories about the migrant caravan in Central America and its connection to George Soros and the international Jewish community. And then, as you said, apparently agitated and morbidly inspired by the conversation he was having with other racists and anti-Semites on Gab, he said, "Screw your optics, I'm going in." And that was his last post on Gab before he went into that synagogue.
Well, let's listen to the company's CEO. This is Andrew Torba talking with WBRE-TV in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania on Saturday. Said he was horrified to find out this alleged terrorist was on our site, but he denied the site gave safe harbor to violent people.
I fundamentally believe in the free expression and individual liberty and the fundamental human right for everybody to speak freely. Obviously, threats of violence are not included in that, and there are other regulations around the freedom of speech and the First Amendment, of course. But I do think that more speech is always going to be the answer to combat bad speech or hate speech.
Derek, what about that argument that Torba is saying they're just committed to free speech?
Well, look, the First Amendment is first for a reason. The founders of this country, the authors of our Constitution, they do place above all other enumerated rights the freedom of worship and the freedom of expression. But there are limits to freedom of expression, as there have to be. You're not allowed to lie under oath, even though you could argue that's freedom of expression. You're not allowed to include false statements in legal contracts or economic contracts. And then speech that's considered threatening or speech that advocates violent action is also not considered constitutional. And what we have here is an example of anti-Semitic messages and hate speech bleeding into a message of violent action. Screw your optics, I'm going in. Bleeding into actual violent action, one of the worst anti-Semitic crimes in America's history. So, you know, what do I make of this statement that Gab is committed to being a platform of free speech? Well, I think Gab is committed to being a platform for free hate speech. And that's legal, but it's also despicable. And if other companies want to condemn and cut ties with a despicable platform for hate speech, then they too enjoy that right under law.
Well, we mentioned GoDaddy did cut ties. Also, PayPal, Medium, Stripe, and Joyent have cut ties to the site since the shooting on Saturday. But a message posted to the site says Gab isn't going anywhere. How do they plan to get back online?
It's not clear. The short answer is that Gab has said it could be online by this weekend. It has to find another domain provider. I don't know of another domain provider that to date has said that they want to host Gab. Maybe one will emerge from the woodwork. I'm unfortunately rather sure that they'll find one, but I don't know when that will happen.
Is there any criminal liability for a social media site or its founders if someone posts threats and then carries out an attack like this?
So as a matter of constitutional law, social media companies can do basically whatever they want. If Facebook wants to become, you know, an exclusive platform for Venezuelan socialists, it can do that. If it wants to become, on the other hand, a book club for Ayn Rand lovers to discuss the Fountainhead, it can do that too. These social networks can be almost whatever they want to be, and they're probably not criminally liable for hate speech under current law. But even if they can't be criminally punished for hate speech, they can be financially punished for hate speech. People can say, I don't want to go on to Twitter because I'm assaulted by anti-Semitic messages or assaulted by, you know, anti-woman messages. And so Facebook and Twitter have taken pains, probably not done enough, but they've started to try to crack down on hate speech and bullying on their platforms. Mm-hmm. And Gab, to be clear, is an alternative to these efforts that Facebook and Twitter have undertaken.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.